Malaysia's Minister of Industry says that economic relations between Tehran and Kuala Lumpur can be further expanded despite U.S. sanctions on Iran. Iran's president says the main obstacle to progress of the Vienna talks is the U.S. administration's pursuit of the failed policies of its predecessor. And Canadian police threaten to arrest truckers and other demonstrators who have shut down central Ottawa for 2 weeks now in protest at COVID restrictions. Details just ahead. Hello, everyone. A very warm welcome to World News. Now, our top story, Iran and Malaysia can strengthen economic ties despite U.S. sanctions. That's according to Malaysia's Plantation Industries and Commodities Minister, Zureida Kamarudin. In an exclusive interview with Press TV, Kamarudin says the two countries can use barter for their trade transactions as a way to get around U.S. sanctions. She says Tehran and Kuala Lumpur are discussing the possibility of using local currencies, which could greatly boost the volume of bilateral trade. The Malaysian minister believes Iran has the potential to become a hub for exports of Malaysian commodities, particularly palm oil, to Central Asia. Iran has hosted a conference on trade with Africa. Event brought under one roof Iranian and African firms and government officials to discuss ways to expand bilateral trade. Yusuf Jalali reports from Tehran.
They call it the forgotten treasure here. Africa is now a serious trade target for Iran. Iranian and African businessmen and officials came together in a major conference in Tehran to discuss ways to boost commercial ties. The current trade volume between Iran and Africa is as low as $200 million a year. It's almost nothing compared to a whopping $20 trillion consumer market in Africa. Iranian authorities say this lucrative market has been neglected for decades, and it's time to interact more with the Black Continent.
Iran is a very good, has got very good potentials to go through this very good and the precious market, I mean the African countries. We believe if we mobilized by the government as well as the private sector, we can go through it.
To gain a foothold in the Black Continent, Iran faces a major hurdle, and that's U.S. sanctions, which complicate banking transactions. Furthermore, the Islamic Republic will have to compete with a giant rival in Africa, China, which has the lion's share in the African economy, possessing roughly 16% of the total trade in the continent. However, given Africa's high demand for energy, food, and technology, African officials believe there's still a good chance for Iran to find a position in their market.
Iran has great capacities in machinery, technology, which Africa can benefit from. Africa, we have a lot of resources untapped, which Nigeria and African countries can benefit from the experience and expertise and the technology of Iran.
Closer interaction with Africa comes as part of Iran's new shift in foreign policy under President Ebrahim Raisi. Raisi believes Iran has to focus on thwarting U.S. sanctions instead of waiting for their removal through political negotiations. The focal point of this new approach is the expansion of ties with non-Western states, and Africa plays a central role in this effort.
Africa has not been a household name in Iran's foreign business, but officials here say it will soon come to be. Iran's government says it's time to untie the country's economy from the fate of the 2015 deal and find new trade partners. And Africa is one of those viable markets that mutually welcomes trade with Iran. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the News Review program, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. Iran's president has taken a jab at the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden for sticking to the failed policies of his predecessor against the Islamic Republic. Ebrahim Raisi noted that this approach is the main obstacle to achieving acceptable progress towards reviving the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. Raisi made the comments in a phone call with the Japanese Prime Minister. Fumio Kishida, for his part, expressed his country's support for the restoration of the accord. Iran and the remaining signatories to the JCPOA resumed talks in the Austrian capital Tuesday. Iran wants the removal of sanctions that the U.S. imposed following its unilateral pullout of the deal in 2018. Tehran is also seeking guarantees that Washington will not leave the deal again. Joining us now for our program is Mr. Mark Weber, Director of the Institute for Historical Review from California, and Lawrence Davidson, former lecturer at Westchester University, joining us from Westchester, Pennsylvania. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess, Mr. Mark Weber, we'll start with you. Your initial thoughts on why the Biden administration, after it criticized the Trump administration's approach and withdrawal from the JCPOA so much, why it hasn't really shown honest resolve in standing in front of some of the anti-Iran hawks there in Washington and getting this thing done?
Right, there's a strong motivation, or should be a strong motivation, by the Biden administration to restore the 2015 agreement, because after all, Joe Biden had pledged that he would do that. But the world expected and more or less hoped and thought would happen that the Biden administration simply restore the agreement that was broken by the Trump administration. That hasn't happened. It's, I think, part of the reason, a very important factor in all of this, is the tremendous anti-Iran hysteria in the media that's echoed by politicians of both major parties. That if simply restoring the agreement will be seen by many critics of the Biden administration as giving in, supposedly, to Iran. It's all theater and stupidity in a sense. But the Biden administration, much to the surprise of many people, did not just simply go back to accepting and going and being in compliance with the agreement that it denounced the Trump administration for leaving, but has continued to impose the sanctions policy of the Trump administration, which, by the way, is entirely illegal under international law. I was more optimistic a few weeks ago that the Biden administration was just about or would very soon restore compliance with the agreement. That's not happened, and I think it may be that time has gone by and that the anti-Iran sentiment promoted in the media and so forth is so strong that that seems less likely than it was just a few weeks ago.
Thank you, Mr. Mark Weber. And Lawrence Davidson, welcome to the program. Hope you're safe and doing well out there in Westchester. Now, Larry, Iran says it will accept nothing less than a return to the 2015 JCPOA. The Biden administration somehow wants a 2022 version of the JCPOA. Trump, we don't know what he really wanted. He just wanted something completely different than anything that was on the table that would have completely benefited Israel, Saudi Arabia, and Washington, and to Iran's, you know, at Iran's cost. Basically, I'm going to put the same question I put to Mark to you. Biden called it, back when Trump withdrew in May of 2018, abject failure to withdraw from the JCPOA. Why haven't we seen a true initiative from his administration?
Yeah, I think that the pledge at the time he was running for election was just that. I mean, it was a campaign kind of statement. He might have been surrounded with advisors who would, ideally like to achieve that. But I think once he got elected, it became much less of a priority, because the man is really, he's distracted by multiple domestic problems, and the source of the pressure on him is not just generally both, hawks in both parties. It's almost specifically the Zionists and the Israeli lobby, and he is, unfortunately, he is very, very much empathetic and sympathetic to the Zionist position. And so what he has done is let this drift. And if ultimately it doesn't get done, he'll just say, well, the Iranians were obstreperous and wouldn't meet us halfway and all that kind of stuff. And the American people who know less than nothing about these things will take it. And so he doesn't feel that there's anything here that he has to rush to. And he doesn't feel that if it fails, it won't hurt him. That's what he thinks. And so he's let it drift.
Right. And Mark, I mean, and you mentioned, both you and Larry mentioned the divide right now in Washington. Let's couple that with Biden's low approval rating, the way it stands right now. The atmosphere. I mean, is it even prudent for Iran to pursue a revival of the JCPOA with this divided establishment where Joe Biden stands as the man right now in his administration? Can we even trust a return if we go one step beyond, if it's going to happen? Let's say it does happen. Can Iran trust that it will be upheld this time, given the current context of how it's happening and the person in charge of what is happening in Washington right now?
Well, the events of the past year, the actual actions of the Biden administration already show, I think, to the world that the Biden administration's claim to what he calls a rule-based international order is basically empty words. The important thing is that we're seeing the continuation of a very important trend in the world. The world is moving away from just following the United States. This is a more important underlying trend that we're seeing. Increasingly, around the world, countries see their own interests, not just their outlook, not just their sentiments, but their interests are increasingly out of sync with the policies that the United States will press around the world. Remember, these sanctions that the Biden administration imposes aren't directed just against Iran. They're directed against countries and companies that act in compliance with the 2015 agreement. The Biden administration will pay a price. The price will be just increasingly the sense around the world that the credibility of the United States isn't there, that the pledges of the United States are words, and that people cannot count on the United States to follow through on whatever claims it happens to be made. And that's why it's wise for Iran, China, Russia, and increasingly other countries to just make their own agreements, just work around the United States as best they can, because United States policy is inconsistent, it's incoherent, and it can't be trusted.
And final thoughts with you, Larry. Vienna talks. From the Biden administration's perspective, some people feel like it's just for show to divert attention from certain crises back home, possibly to appease the Europeans that weren't too fond of Trump opting out of the accord. Maybe there is no will whatsoever by the administration there in the White House to get this thing done. Maybe it's just a diversion.
I'm not sure it's a diversion, but it is. There is no real will, as you say, to get this thing done. I would still not like to see the Iranians leave the table first. There's not much cost to them to stick it out and so be able to say, well, it's the Americans who left the room first. I think that there's some symbolic value to having it go that way. I agree, there's no will to get this thing done. And I'm very pessimistic that it will get done. And I think that the Americans are continuing to meet in Vienna, largely because of expectations on the part of the Europeans. And they're trying to save their credibility with the Europeans. Of course, again, it's probably not going to work. The Europeans do what the Americans want in these cases, largely not in principle, but because they get harmed. You know, their economic positions get harmed if they don't. That can only last for a limited amount of time, one would hope. And so sooner or later, they will stop listening to Washington.
And do you share that sentiment? Seems like you do, Mark. 30 seconds. Your final thoughts, please.
No, not entirely. I mean, there is a motive for the Biden administration to come to restore the agreement. Again, the biggest motive is, if it doesn't, it will show that even its own pledges to the American people can't be trusted, and it will also show that the United States is not a trustworthy partner internationally. Look, the JCPOA agreement isn't just something to talk about. It's a binding international agreement. If the United States flaunts and shows contempt for a United Nations Security Council resolution, as important as this one, an agreement that represents a kind of world consensus, that's not good for the United States, no matter what the administration might think about not caring about American domestic policy. The rest of the world will look at the United States increasingly, it already is looking at the United States increasingly, as a country of words and whose word cannot be trusted.
Gentlemen, thank you both. Time has gotten the better of us. I want to thank you both for joining us on the program. And stay safe, both of you. Mark Weber out of California and Lawrence Davidson there from Westchester, Pennsylvania. Protests in the Canadian capital, Ottawa, against COVID restrictions drag on for almost 2 weeks as authorities have warned of economic damage to the country. Protesters opposing a vaccine mandate for cross-border truckers have also blocked two main crossings to the U.S. A key link used to move goods between the two neighbors, known as Ambassador Bridge, has been shut down since Monday night. Another border crossing in Alberta has also been closed since Tuesday night. Police have threatened to arrest protesters blocking streets in Ottawa. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has called the blockades unacceptable and a threat to the economy. The White House has also warned that protest action risks hurting the auto industry. The U.S. appears to be establishing a base in Poland as tensions are soaring between Russia and the West over Ukraine. Latest footage shows the U.S. military has set up a tent barracks base near Mielec Airport in southeastern Poland. A series of U.S. elite forces, advanced groups, and military hardware have recently landed in an airport near the Polish border with Ukraine. This after U.S. President Joe Biden ordered the deployment of 1,700 soldiers there. U.S. and its European allies are accusing Russia of preparing an invasion of Ukraine. Moscow denies it has any such plan, saying that Washington is trying to drag it into a war by creating tensions near Russian borders. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
چتو قرمز و سبز و سپید نمانم من نمان منم من ذره خاک وطنم من ذره خاک وطنم من ایران خاک دلیران ایران کنام شیران ایران همیشه جاویدان.
This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
In the limelight.
New Climate Institute says Amazon, IKEA, Nestle, and other major firms will fall short of promise to cut carbon emissions by 100%. We are prepared for you an article written by Fiona Harvey under the heading Research Suggests World's Biggest Firms Failing Over Net Zero Claims. Some of the world's biggest businesses are failing to live up to claims they will hit net zero carbon emission targets, according to research that suggests they will cut their carbon emissions by only 40% rather than the 100% cuts claimed. Household names such as Amazon, IKEA, Nestle and Unilever are among the major companies named as showing little substance to their claims that they will cut emissions drastically. Thomas Day of New Climate Institute, who compiled the new report, said that, taken in aggregate, the efforts of the 25 companies studied would make little impact. He said, "It is not clear these reductions take us beyond business as usual," adding, "We were very disappointed and surprised at how much room for improvement there was among the companies studied. Companies need to be much more transparent about these goals." Thomas Day added, near-term targets were of particular concern. The report showed that the companies surveyed would only cut their carbon emissions by about 23% on average by 2030, falling far short of the figure of nearly halving in the next decade that scientists say is needed to limit global heating to just 1.5 degrees Celsius. Thomas Day added, "It's short-term action that's the most important thing in this climate crisis. Many are relying on carbon offsetting for a large proportion of their projected cuts. Carbon offsetting is the controversial practice of paying for projects that reduce carbon dioxide, usually for maintaining forests or growing new trees, to compensate for greenhouse gases emitted elsewhere. Many of the companies studied have made much of their public claims to environmental sustainability." Thomas Day said, "Some companies I had expected more from, given their very positive perception, such as IKEA, Unilever, and Nestle." The Corporate Climate Responsibility Monitor by New Climate Institute and Carbon Market Watch scored companies on criteria including their targets, how much offsetting they plan to use, and the reliability of those offsets, as well as progress on reducing their own carbon emissions and how transparent they were in their target setting and corporate reporting. According to these benchmarks, none of the 25 major companies rated were judged to achieve a high standard. Among those showing low integrity were Amazon and IKEA, while the 11 companies that ranked worse in the study showing very low integrity, including EON and Nestle. Thomas Day said the overuse of offsetting was one of the main reasons most companies were marked down. Offsetting is increasingly popular among companies seeking to burnish their green credentials and is set to become even more so through a new standards body. Critics say that many offsetting projects have been found to be of doubtful value and some have been fraudulent. Forestry also makes a poor substitution for immediate carbon emission cuts, as carbon emitted into the atmosphere today begins to heat the atmosphere now and continues to do so for at least a century, while trees take decades to grow and store carbon absorbed from the air. Proponents counter that with deforestation rampant across the world, preserving existing forests is one of the most important ways of tackling the climate crisis. Thomas Day said using offsetting tended to obscure whether companies were making genuine progress on cutting their own carbon emissions or hiding behind offsets to achieve a notional net zero. He said it's better practice not to offset. It's more transparent and more constructive, adding, companies should not be claiming their net zero by 2030 unless they're reducing their carbon emissions by 90% by then. He was also concerned at the apparent poor quality of some of the offsetting projects that companies were using. He said, if they insist on offsetting, at least it should be with carbon credits that have more integrity. An Amazon spokesperson claimed the company had a goal of reaching net zero carbon emissions by 2040. The spokesperson said, "We set these ambitious targets because we know that climate change is a serious problem and action is needed now more than ever. Amazon is on a path to powering our operations with 100% renewable energy by 2025, 5 years ahead of our original target." An EON spokesperson claimed, "In our view, the report is not only methodologically incorrect, but its results are misleading. EON's carbon footprint is based on the principles of the globally applicable greenhouse gas accounting standard." EON was again included in the A-list by CDP, the Carbon Disclosure Project, for its climate reporting in 2021. A spokesperson for IKEA asserted, "While IKEA has achieved much already, such as breaking the link between decreasing our absolute emissions while increasing business growth, we have plans in place to address our remaining complex challenges, such as the climate footprint of the materials used in the IKEA range." Benjamin Ware, the global head of the climate delivery and sustainable sourcing at Nestlé, also claimed, "We welcome scrutiny of our actions and commitments on climate change. However, the report lacks understanding of our approach and contains significant inaccuracies. Our climate roadmap has been validated by the Science-Based Targets Initiative, a corporate sustainability body. The work that went into it is rigorous and extensive." A spokesperson for Unilever said, "While we share different perspectives on some elements of this report, we welcome external analysis of our progress and have begun a productive dialogue with the new Climate Institute to see how we can meaningfully evolve our approach." But climate campaigners said companies should be able to use carbon offsets to meet climate targets. The practice of offsetting, funding the planting of trees or protection of forests, or other projects that reduce carbon emissions to make up for a company or individual's emissions has become increasingly controversial. Some fraudulent schemes have been uncovered in which carbon credits did not exist or did not represent an actual reduction in carbon emissions. Other schemes have been found to fail to protect forests, allowing logging to continue while selling carbon credits based on keeping forests standing.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. This is IRIB English Radio. Once more, I have the honor to be your host. This is Asma, and from Muslim Ladies Studio, I invite you to our cozy corner where we talk about some important stuff concerning Muslim lady. So, welcome to your own zone, dear ladies. Here with me, I have an amazing guest, Sister Shamali. Thank you for joining us and welcome to today's program.
Thank you very much for having me. Assalamu alaikum to all the brothers and sisters who are listening to our program. An honor to be here.
Well, I'm very pleased to be here with you.
Thank you.
This is the first time I'm meeting you, actually.
Yeah,
shall you please tell me a little bit about the area of your study?
I've been doing research in the field of women and family for the past couple of 10 years, and now I'm a PhD candidate in the field of women's rights in Islam.
Yes. As you know, we are getting close to the anniversary of the victory of Islamic Revolution, in which women had a remarkable role. We open up this episode in honor of all the great women who watered the tree of Islam with the blood of their men and helped it flourish with their strength and endurance. We already know that there is a striking difference in the conditions of Muslim lady before and after the Islamic Revolution. Things changed, and I think it's pretty safe to say that women got plenty of freedom and independence. Revolution has offered many notable modifications to women's life. To cut a long story short, and before I go too long with my introduction, I would like to jump into the heart of today's discussion, which talks about the fruits of Islamic revolution regarding women. What chances has the revolution brought for women? I mean, those of their expectations. You see, after any kind of revolution happens, men and women both have some expectations from the coming revolution. There has been many mottos and a slogan throughout the history. When they're trying to go through a revolution, they say we do blah, blah for women, for men, and mostly they use women, you know? What was the slogan that revolution promised women to give them? And what are the exact and real events that happened after the revolution for women? What kind of chances the revolution has given all these women?
The Islamic Revolution of Iran was an Islamic revolution where people were not happy with the previous regime and with the fact that there was a lot of injustice in the society.
Because they had a very important role in that revolution, I'm saying, how many of their expectations came to be true?
The difference between women after the Islamic Revolution and before the Islamic Revolution is that the mentality, the worldview of people changed. I mean, they didn't like the secular society where women are treated more like sexual objects. You know, the fact that...
You mean in past it was like this, that they had a sexual overview upon women. The majority of women were at their home, doing chores, perhaps. And very little number of women had the chance to go to university.
In the past two, three, four centuries ago, women did not have much power. And they just got the right to vote in the year 1920. So up until then, women did throughout the world, in Western, Eastern societies, Muslim and non-Muslim, they were deprived of so many of their essential rights, right? And then after the feminist movement, after the spread of the feminist movement in the world, things changed. But the thing is that we believe that in Islam, these rights that women were fighting in the feminist movement had already been given to women 14 centuries before.
Yes.
Right? So,
but those rights... to come into practice, you know, to give women rights is one thing, and to bring it into practice is another thing.
Yeah, you know, the thing is that at the time of the old regime, the Pahlavi regime, the Reza Shah and his son had the view that for a society to flourish and to, you know, grow and to be very successful, mm-hmm. they would have to copy the model of Turkey, for example.
Exactly.
Part of the reason that women are so backwarded and, you know, the society is backwarded is because of hijab. Mm-hmm. Is because women and men are segregated. They're not together. It's because women are not educated. So what happened is that they passed a very big change. They encouraged a very big change and, you know, the move to remove women's hijab exactly. and to have, like, girls and boys together
to
in
force
schools.
Them.
Yeah, so these things happened. And Iran was a very religious country. The people of Iran were very religious, and they were anti these changes. They were opposing to these changes.
So you mean the reason of women being isolated was this fact. The regime forced women to follow the rules of Western models.
Yeah.
And since Iranian ladies were actually religious women, they could not go exactly according to those rules. That's why we couldn't see so much of women.
Women did not have a lot of power back then. It was their men who decided for them.
Mm-hmm.
That because women were somehow considered to be belonging to their husbands, and
yes.
they decided that
their
they had
property.
To go out of their house, even until 50, 60, 70 years ago. I'm not talking about, like, the past.
Yes. After revolution, things changed.
Exactly.
For the benefit of women.
Yes. We're just generalizing things. Mm-hmm. Like, things change. What exactly do we mean by things change?
Yes.
You have to give them a good context where they would understand that what kind of change we're talking about. So, like, they preserved the hijab 60 years ago. But then the reason that the women preserved the hijab was not because they considered themselves to be, like, very valuable, or it was, you know, so that the human aspect, the humanistic aspect of women would be brought up and would be highlighted, and that the physical attractions would be, you know, hidden. It was more because the men thought that, well, this woman, this Zaife, this weak person mm-hmm. is under my control. I am her guardian. I am her supervisor. And she's mine. She shouldn't go out. And so she should have the hijab so that no one could see her and that she couldn't see anyone. They didn't even allow their women to go and study. And, like, the only places that women did learn something was that they went to the maktabkhanas, or even in their own houses, they had...
Maktabkhana is a place where they studied.
They studied the Quran, basically,
yes,
and they
basically.
Teach you the alphabets, the mm-hmm. Arabic alphabet and the Farsi alphabet.
So, as you can see, women did not have many chances of education.
Yeah, they didn't have, because they didn't believe that women should be educated.
Yes,
because the
yes.
main responsibility of the woman was to be a very submissive wife.
Doing
and
chores.
To do the house chores, because that was her responsibility. Mm-hmm. And then to be a very good mom, to raise good children. So mm-hmm. these were the things, the expectations of people from women before the Islamic Revolution. I mean, about a century ago, this is how the mentality of people was back then. And then Imam Khomeini came. Imam Khomeini came.
Yes. He actually gave a right to every single member of society. Women, men. I mean, he talked a lot about women.
What kind of right?
What kind of rights? They have to be educated. They have to come to society. They have to be actively involved in everything. He clarified their rights for them. In religious learnings, we have learned that there are some rights for men and also there are some rights for women.
Mm-hmm.
Before revolution, there wasn't much of rights of women. It was mostly about men.
Mm-hmm.
We're basically talking about what happened after revolution. Mm-hmm. The sort of things that happened to women. You see the drastic change that came within the revolution.
Mm-hmm.
After just some years, women started to go to universities. I mean, after the war, of course. after the situation was settled, you can see there is a very drastic change in society.
I think the
women
change,
are everywhere.
It started mm-hmm. during the revolution.
Mm-hmm.
Women were the revolution makers in Iran. They were the initiators of the one of the main pillars and one of the main initiators of the
Can you
revolution.
Explain more on that?
You see that this was the view of Imam Khomeini, where he says that in different speeches that he delivered, he talks about how women can play a very tremendous role in changing the lives of people
mm-hmm.
and in changing the fate of a community.
Mm-hmm.
And he encouraged women. He gave them the courage to come out of their homes and even to motivate their own husbands and their mm-hmm. own sons to take part
to
in the revolution.
To back them up and support them in what they're doing.
Even they you, if you see the films, if you see the pictures of the people demonstrating in the streets mm-hmm. during the revolution, you see a lot of women taking part.
Exactly.
You know, and hijabi and non-hijabi women, they believe
yes,
that they
them.
Have to, yeah, they have to support the change. And they were after the slogans of Imam Khomeini as the leader of the Islamic revolution. That's pretty much, I mean, the mentality, I mean, the motivation that Imam Khomeini gave women played a very, it gave women courage.
Yes.
To stand up.
Mm-hmm. To speak up.
To speak up. To want good change to happen in the society.
And now for those who do not know a lot about the history of Iran and about the situation back in those times, we said that women were merely weak people and they did not have many chances to good facilities, like good situations like studying, going to university, and perhaps many of them didn't even have reach to books, to study books, to read books. We saw that the universities opened a lot of chances for women.
Mm.
They became experts in many areas.
Mm-hmm.
They came to help men hand in hand in many different things. You know, this is what I'm talking about. We started to see them in society, in parliament, and in
the increase in the number of women in universities, in the different majors. Generally speaking, one of the things that happened after the Islamic Revolution was that very academic, advanced seminaries started up for women. One of the achievements of the Islamic Revolution was that to give men and women,
mm-hmm.
Not only women, but you know, to give
the
them
access
the facility.
To universities and facilities, educational facilities.
Exactly.
Dear listeners, mothers, sisters, wives and daughters, ladies of any kind, thanks for giving us your ears and attention. The whole cast of Muslim Lady and I wish you health and happiness. Take care until another session. May Allah protect you.
Who is the lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity. Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
the Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In the United States, the Supreme Court on Monday, 7th of February, reinstated an Alabama congressional map that a lower court had said diluted the power of black voters, suggesting that the court was poised to become more skeptical of challengers to voting maps based on claims of race discrimination. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Adam Liptak. The piece is titled, Supreme Court in 5-4 Vote Restores Alabama's Congressional Voting Map. In the United States, the Supreme Court on Monday reinstated an Alabama congressional map that a lower court had said diluted the power of black voters, suggesting that the court was poised to become more skeptical of challengers to voting maps based on claims of race discrimination. The vote was 5-4, with Chief Justice John Roberts joining the court's three liberal members in dissent. The Supreme Court's brief order, which included no reasoning, was provisional, staying a lower court's decision while the case moves forward. The justices said they would hear Alabama's appeal of the lower court's ruling, but they did not say when. Both the stay and the decision to hear the case indicated that the court is open to weakening the role race may play in drawing voting districts for federal elections, setting up a major new test of the Voting Rights Act in a court that has gradually limited the reach of the law in other contexts. The dispute in Alabama is part of a pitched redistricting battle playing out across the country, with Democrats and Republicans alike challenging electoral districts as unlawful gerrymanders. Those challenges have mostly been filed in state courts, meaning the U.S. Supreme Court is unlikely to intervene. Civil rights leaders and some Democrats say the redistricting process often disadvantages growing minority communities, including African Americans and Hispanics. Republican state officials say the Constitution allows only a limited role for the consideration of race in drawing voting districts. If the court follows its usual practices, it will schedule arguments in the Alabama case for the fall and issue a decision months later, meaning that the 2022 midterm elections would be conducted using the challenge map. Alabama has 7 congressional districts and its voting age population is about 27% black. In the challenge map, black voters are in the majority in one district. The lower court, relying on the Voting Rights Act, had ordered the state legislature to create a second district in which black voters could elect a representative of their choice. In a concurring opinion on Monday, 7th of February, Justice Brett Kavanaugh, joined by Justice Samuel Alito, said that the stay order does not make or signal any change to voting rights law. It was necessary, he wrote, because the lower court had acted too soon before a coming election. When an election is close at hand, the rules of the road must be clear and settled, Justice Brett Kavanaugh wrote. Late judicial tinkering with election laws can lead to disruption and to unanticipated and unfair consequences for candidates, political parties, and voters, among others. It is one thing for a state on its own to toy with its election laws close to a state's election, he wrote. But it is quite another thing for a federal court to swoop in and redo a state's election laws in the period close to an election. In dissent, Chief Justice John Roberts said the lower court in the Alabama case had properly applied existing law in an extensive opinion with no apparent errors for our correction. Still, he wrote, the Supreme Court's precedents have engendered considerable disagreement and uncertainty regarding the nature and contours of a vote dilution claim. The correct solution, the Chief Justice wrote, would have been to agree to hear the state's appeal, but not to grant a stay in the meantime. The practical effect of this approach, he wrote, would be that the 2022 election would take place in accord with the judgment of the district court. But subsequent elections would be governed by this court's decision on review. In a separate dissent, Justice Elena Kagan said the majority had gone badly astray. It does a disservice to the district court, which meticulously applied this court's long-standing voting rights precedent, she wrote. And most of all, it does a disservice to black Alabamians, who, under the precedent, have had their electoral power diminished in violation of a law this court once knew to buttress all of American democracy. Justice Elena Kagan added, the lower court had acted well before the next primary election in late May and the general election in November. Alabama is not entitled to keep violating black Alabamians' voting rights just because the court's order came down in the first month of an election year, she wrote. Justices Stephen Breyer and Sonia Sotomayor joined Justice Kagan's dissent. In earlier decisions, the Supreme Court effectively gutted Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which had required federal approval of changes to state and local voting laws in parts of the country with a history of racial discrimination, and cut back on Section 2 of the law, limiting the ability of minority groups to challenge voting restrictions. The Alabama case also concerns Section 2 of the law, but in the context of redistricting. Section 2 bars any voting procedure that results in a denial or abridgment of the right of any citizen of the United States to vote on account of race. That happens, the provision goes on, when based on the totality of the circumstances, racial minorities have less opportunity than other members of the electorate to participate in the political process and to elect representatives of their choice. In November, Alabama's legislature, which is controlled by Republicans, redrew the state's 7-district congressional map to take account of the 2002 census. It maintained a single district in which black voters make up a majority. That district has long elected a Democrat, while the state's other 6 districts are represented by Republicans. After the map was challenged by black voters and advocacy groups, a unanimous 3-judge panel of the Federal District Court in Birmingham, Alabama, ruled last month that the legislature should have fashioned a 2nd district in which black voters either comprise a voting age majority or something quite close to it. The unsigned decision was joined by Judge Stanley Marcus, who ordinarily sits on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit in Atlanta, Georgia, and was appointed by President Bill Clinton, and by judges Anna Manasco and Terry Moore, both appointed by President Donald Trump. The panel found that voting in the state is racially polarized and that it will be possible to draw a 2nd reasonably configured district to allow black voters to elect their favored candidates. The panel ordered the legislature to submit new maps within 2 weeks and said it would appoint an independent expert to do so if the deadline was not met. Primary elections are scheduled for this May. Alabama officials asked the Supreme Court for an emergency stay. They said that the panel's ruling would result in massive disruption of the state's elections and that Alabamians will suffer the constitutional harm of being assigned to racially segregated districts. It will result, they wrote, in a map that can be drawn only by placing race first above race-neutral districting criteria, sorting and splitting voters across the state on the basis of race alone. The panel's ruling, they added, is premised on the noxious idea that redistricting begins and ends with racial considerations. In response, lawyers for Greater Birmingham Ministries, the Alabama State Conference of the NAACP, and several voters said there was ample time and no risk of confusion. The primary is still over 4 months away, and the election itself over 10 months away, they wrote. No election has ever been held under the challenge plan, so there is no risk of voter confusion. In a separate response, lawyers for a 2nd set of voters said that granting a stay would do a severe disservice to the public interest by rendering unlawful plans functionally immune from challenge during the 1st election of a redistricting cycle, signaling to states that they get a free pass on their plans so long as they delay enactment until it is too late for courts of law to provide relief.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.